So
we should probably get started, Dennis.
Yeah, let's get on with this. You know, the very first call that we did with Live Alchemies was with Barry Carter. And, you know, Barry's the guy who basically got this whole movement kicked off. And so it's really good to have you back on the call as a guest, Barry, because you've been such a contributor in every way that I bet there's lots and lots of people got questions for you who want to pick your brains, your encyclopedic knowledge of Ormus. But in the meantime, why don't you give a little bit of a history about how you got into this and what appealed to you about this whole, what made Ormus happen for you? And tell us about what results you've had and what results your friends have had along the way. Yeah?
Yeah. Well, I started out as a child, and as a child, I was really, really interested in science fiction and generally the future and technology and all of that. Then, in about 1967, 68, I started reading Edgar Cayce and prophecies and stuff like that, and I became concerned that the way the world was going, that there may be problems that we would have to deal with as a society or as a culture. I've always been self-employed, more or less. I've always had my own source of income. I was a cabinet maker for a long time, and I worked as an environmental activist for a long time. Doing all of these things, I always continued to want to be able to be in a position to do something to get the world in a better place, so to speak, so that we could have better food. I've always been very concerned about chemicals in the food and nutrition and having plenty of nutrients and all of that. I've always been concerned about improving spiritual connection and things like that. And so I've been sort of focusing on all of those things. In a way, all of this Ormus stuff is a manifestation of all of this stuff that I've been interested in. Or a way of getting all of this stuff that I've been interested in to work better. Basically, we're finding that Ormus can help food, help make food more nutritious. We're finding that it can do things for energy and energy problems, and do things for global warming and all of the things that I was concerned about in the past. Also, I've noticed that all of my skill that I learned as a cabinet maker and as an environmental activist, I'm using all of those skills involved with the Ormus work. When I was a cabinet maker, I learned to work with tools and so on, and so when I learned about the possibility of trapping Ormus out of fresh water using a magnetic trap, I had everything that I needed to build magnetic traps and to design them. And I had the skills and all of that was necessary for that. And I had the tools for processing water, for making seawater into precipitate. So all of those things have been really quite easy for me, just because it was all set up earlier to my existing skills. And as an environmental activist, what I did was I ran a regional environmental organization that encompassed several smaller organizations. And my work there was to network people, to get people together, to get people working together. And that's one of the focuses that I've had with the Ormus, is to get people working together. The more people in a given area that are working together, the better, the smoother things go for each and every one of those people. And in service to that, in the Ormus realm, I've been focusing mostly on setting up local forums on the Internet so that people can get together and work together. Now, Dennis is part of the Sydney Forum in Australia. Could you tell us a little bit about the meeting that you had there recently where you met with some of the other people there and some of the things that you did? Dennis?
Yeah, well, we planned this Sydney meeting for a little while. And just so you guys know, I live about an hour's flight away from Sydney these days in the lovely Gold Coast and Queensland. Queensland's a state about twice as big as Texas. And where I live is at the latitude of Orlando in Florida. And so Sydney, in terms of the latitude of in the U.S., would probably be around about North Carolina. And anyway, so I flew for the Ormus meeting, and we had it at Dr. Jen's medical practice, the office. There's a nice big boardroom there, and we had about a dozen people show up, and we had a really great demonstration of how to make wet method from Bill, and Bill's a really canny guy who's around about, oh God, he'd have to be 65 or 70 these days, really old hand in the Ormus business, you might say, and we had a really good turnout. And the Ormus that was made on the spot was pretty good too. Bill also has a magnetic trap that he originally got off Barry Carter when Barry was down in Australia. And I have to say the Sydney group is fairly active group. I get posts from them sometimes two or three a day, and apparently that's not all that common amongst the regional groups. But Sydney is a fairly alive group. So that's really worth flying down for.
Like,
it was great fun.
I wish that all the groups were like Sydney. Right now it looks like there's a flurry of activity onto the France group. I've had three people join the France group just today. Somebody must have posted something on some forum in France that has encouraged people to join that group.
And we've got a couple of people in Louisiana. There's a seat of a micro group, and in L.A. And it doesn't really, look, I tell you, it doesn't take much to organize a get-together and invite a few of your interested friends, and suddenly, whoopee, whammo, a group is happening.
Okay,
and it's really powerful and useful because there's no substitute for physical contact of meeting, greeting, and eating, because it somehow gets installed in our psyche much deeper if when we have an actual in physical presence connection with other people in our group. And I particularly want to recommend that you guys think about getting Barry to your city. Because once you get Barry to your city and you get some people in front of him, they will get absolutely their money and time's worth. Because just Barry being who he is and the way he is, around about one-third of the people at the Sydney meeting had Barry's introduction. So it absolutely is a valuable input if you can get Barry to your city. So that's it from Sydney.
Now, you learned how to do this from Dr. Jen, right?
Yeah. Well, Dr. Jen did that seminar with you.
Mm-hmm.
She just happened to know the guy who had organized your tour in Australia, and she did one day of one of your weekends in Byron Bay, another day in Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
And I had met Dr. Jen in another context on a houseboat on a seminar promoting the Tesla plates. We hit it off and had a great time together, and she came to visit, and I was raving about my new discovery, because she's a pretty complementary medicine type of medical practitioner, who's also a shiatsu trainer and intuitive healer as well, which is an unusual combination. And I was raving about this white powder gold that I was interested in, and I just bought a little vial from whitepowdergold.com in Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a tiny little vial, and I'd used it twice, and about 20% of it had disappeared. And I went, God, this is going to go fast. So she told me that it's possible to make M-State out of the ocean. It seemed like, what? Out of the ocean? I've got so much ocean on my back doorstep. How could that be? Anyway, she kept telling me that I needed to go and get this copy of Living Now, a local free sort of publication that goes to health food shops and so on, because they had an article on Ormus that month. So I went and got it and loved it so much. I went and got 20 copies so I could share with friends who came around. And the next time Jen came to stay, she showed me how to make Ormus. And we had some pH papers, and we had some lye crystals that she bought, and I had a couple of containers by then. And by then, I started to learn to douse, and I was dousing the levels of consciousness of this and that and the other, and this original white powder gold stuff that I got from Tennessee, which actually didn't douse really high compared to the Ormus that most people make these days.
Mm-hmm.
But the first Ormus that I made was around about one quarter the strength of this white powder gold solution from Tennessee. And then the next one was made, the next batch that I made was double that. And in a very short period of time, according to this dousing, I was making Ormus that had a much higher level of consciousness and potency, and in a very short period of time, I started picking up stuff on these forums because I found out about the Ormus forum and started picking up hints. And it turns out that there's so many invisible aspects to Ormus,
mm-hmm.
and I really learned that the basis of homeopathy is that water has memory. And it occurred to me that if you're having a cup of tea with someone and you have an argument with them, surely that argument is going to be captured by that cup of tea. And do you want to drink that argument?
There you go. Well, this
surely
this
you'd make yourself another
stuff.
Cup of tea, wouldn't you?
Yeah. This is a lot of the
so
stuff.
So anyway,
that
I learned that the energy that the Ormus is made in is going to be captured by that Ormus. In some way, Ormus is conscious. And I cannot possibly justify how that could possibly be, but it behaves like it is. Yeah.
Could I ask a quick question, the making of Ormus? When you're in water,
Please speak loudly.
If your water that you start with has a very high concentration of 1+ cations, are those cations transmuted in the trapping process, or do those cations remain after trapping?
I don't think anybody really knows the answer to that.
So you'd have to test the trap. You'd have to test the post-trap water.
You'd have to test before and after. Yes.
Thank you.
And it would be really good to do that, because there's so much more that we don't know about Ormus than what we do know, and this is the advantage. This is the wonderful advantage of working together with people in your own area, because since Dennis joined the Sydney Forum, and Dennis isn't in Sydney, he's quite a ways away from Sydney, in fact, and since he joined the Forum, there's been a whole lot of activity there, and the activity was going on before he got there, but even more after he got there. And one of the people that's there on the Forum is a metallurgist named Michael Burberry. Michael isn't working as a metallurgist, but he was one of our interviewees a while back, and he shared just a tremendous amount of really good, brand new information. He has made the white powder out of, I'd say 10 elements that David Hudson never tried. And because of that, he has, I guess, more information about this stuff and what it does as other elements than David Hudson does. And he's been sharing that information with the Sydney group, and then Dennis said, well, hey, that's great information, and let's see if we can get Michael Burberry on one of these calls and share the information around even further. And so that's basically how that happened.
I'd go so far to say that you guys should do your best to get the call of Michael Burberry and have a listen to it, because we had to do two calls with him. The first call just wasn't enough. He had so much more information to share. It just wasn't going to fit into one call. So we had the unprecedented event of having Michael as our guest twice in a row in 1 month, like 2 weeks apart. And it's information rich. He's a fascinating guy, Michael Burberry. He's one of these guys who is far too bright, maybe even for his own good. His dad was an electroplater, so he did a degree in industrial chemistry. And then after a while, he got bored. So he got into engineering for boats. What do they call that? It's a special term, but anyway.
Boat mechanic.
Marine engineering or whatever it is. And then he had a separate career in marine design. And then he had an accident on site, and he couldn't work in that area anymore. So then he did further study, went back to university, and did a degree in electronics and computer hardware and software, and now he's onto his career Mark III as a computer engineer, and he is the top of the tree for a major finance company in Australia, and which is also an international company called GE Capital or GE Finance, you know, the financial arm of General Electric. And he's the where the buck stops in terms of customer service and inquiry and making sure everything works fabulously for the company. And so consequently, he's one of these people who's extraordinarily skilled as an investigator. And because he's got this enormous ability to be a programmer, if he turns his mind to it, could also, in the same breath, be a computer hacker, because they know exactly all the inside tricks to go anywhere on the web. And he discovered all manner of neat stuff that I won't say on a public call like this, but phenomenal investigation ability Michael Burberry has. And the amount of stuff that he kept turning up, he would drop hints on the forums, the Sydney forum and the Ormus forum that he was on, the SWG and so on. And he said he was amazed how few people followed up those hints. He didn't want to make anything too blatant. But if you go back to Michael Burberry's posts on the Ormus forum and the Ormus SWG forum and follow up some of his arcane comments with a bit of research, it's incredibly rewarding because he's got that investigative mindset, and he's been a real gift for the Sydney forum. And these people are out there.
Oh, yeah.
They're not thick on the ground. They're not huge in numbers, but they're out there, and they make a big contribution. And you might have one of them sitting, you know, living in the next suburb away from you. And when you tap into the expertise, it's quite a phenomenal find.
Well, this is how I got involved, is by Run Quay a Wizard.
Was that Jim?
That was Jim. Back in mid-70s, when I was doing cabinet work, I met a guy. I was building some speaker cabinets, and I heard that there was this guy in this little town that was 50 miles north of where I live, and that he was a wizard with speakers and electronics. And so I went and met him and talked to him about this, and his name was Jim, and he told me, gave me some ideas, and I built a speaker, and hey, I still got that speaker. It's a subwoofer, and it's positioned under my bed right now. That made me realize that this Jim was really quite a wizard. So when he eventually moved his speaker manufacturing company to Baker City, where I live, I hung out there whenever I could. You know, I'd go out there and visit him pretty often. And then in about 1984 or 85, Jim had moved to another little town about 10 miles north of where I live called Haines, Oregon. And while he was in Haines, he was still working with speakers, but he also set up, he developed a device that would put a pulsed magnetic field into a bone or soft tissue, and you just wrap your leg with it, and it put this pulsed magnetic field into it, and that would cause bones to heal, broken bones to heal a lot more quickly. And they had permission to test it on for veterinary medicine. And they were going around to all of the medical shows and showing this thing off. And one of these medical shows, Jim noticed that the technology that was currently available for sterilizing medical instruments was just really, really, really terrible stuff. They had to use chemicals that they'd have to keep this stuff in a building. This is especially optical that you can't steam sterilize, optical and electronic stuff. They'd have to keep it in a building isolated for several weeks in order to not contaminate, not poison the people that they were using it with. And so Jim said, I think we can do the same thing with ozone. And so one day I went out to his place in Haines, and he was working with this sterilizing, this ozone generator, and he'd taken a piece of plexiglass and taken a router and gone back and forth and back and forth on the plexiglass, made this track that you could put oxygen through and put a metal plate on one side and a piece of aluminum foil on the other, and hit it with a certain frequency and a certain voltage, and he was getting ozone out of it. And he was getting really, really good ozone, but the plate that he made looked awful. I said, well, I can make a whole lot better one in my wood shop. You know, I had some machine tools and stuff, and so I machined him a better plate, And so he started having me build these flat plates, we call them, to make the ozone generator work. And I built 20 or 30 of them, different parameters, made the closer together or further apart or smaller or different, changed different things. And finally we got one that really, really worked well. And this ozone generator would do stuff that nobody else's ozone generator. One day, it didn't work out to use it for a sterilizer. But one day, we were talking about some environmental problems because I was doing environmental work at around about 1988 and 89. And we had a lot of problems with mine waste, toxic mine waste, and cyanide heap leach mines and stuff like that in eastern Oregon. I said, well, why don't you try it on some cyanide mine waste? And so he did, and it worked great. You know, it was really, really exceptional. And they bubble the ozone through the water, the wastewater, and then run it through some charcoal briquettes. But there was some strange things happening. And this is when I realized that this was the future of practically everything. Inside the charcoal briquettes that they were running this water over after ozonating it, inside the charcoal briquettes, gold would grow inside of those charcoal briquettes. And underneath, into the tank that it dripped into, there would be this, Jim called it snotty stuff. It's snot, is what he called it. And he said, inside this stuff, this oily stuff, it's like mucus, you know, inside that stuff, when you dried it out in the sunlight, it would disappear in a flash of light. And if you dried it out in the dark, it would float away. You couldn't catch it. Jim called it fly ash. And this was like science fiction stuff from when I was a kid. And then when I talked to Michael Burberry, when we had the conference call a couple months ago with Michael Burberry, he talked about how he'd taken dew and basically fermented it. And this fermented dew, if you dried it out and if you reached for it with your hand, it would fly away from your hand. So Michael decided to call it fly ash, just like Jim called his stuff fly ash, because it apparently is the same thing. So when all of this happened, Jim didn't really want to look into this very much more because he accidentally got his hands in some of this stuff and got really kind of sick and because we found out later that he had that the water that he was using had lots of lead and arsenic in it, and so he got lead and arsenic poisoning and the doctor said that he was going to die. Said that they gave him 2 weeks to live, you know, like big gift. But he didn't die. And they thought his kidneys and his liver were going to shut down, but they didn't shut down. You know, he stayed alive. And 18 months later, Jim was still alive, but still he'd like sleep 22 hours a day. He was going through this huge detox, trying to get rid of lead and arsenic, and something was keeping him alive. And I guess we kind of figured out that it must have been something that he got at the same time as the lead and arsenic, and it must have been something related to the stuff that would fly away from your hand and all of that, but we just didn't know. I mean, there were too many mysterious things on this. And my mom had a health food store, and I'd always been interested in nutrition and stuff, so I went to her store and said, is there anything that would be good for getting rid of toxic metals in the body? And she said, oh, yeah, there's this book over here by Kurt Donsbach. It's titled Hydrogen Peroxide, and So I went over and looked at it, and it talked about how you could use hydrogen peroxide to eliminate, help eliminate toxic metals in your body. And so I got some of the hydrogen peroxide they talked about. It's 35% hydrogen peroxide. And I took it to Jim, and I took him the book, and I wasn't sure he'd even try it, but he tried it, and it worked. And he got to feeling better. And this was about 1990. And it was great that he was feeling better, but I was really, really interested in all of his stories about what happened with his stuff. He had a puddle of water that moved across the floor toward the nearest person. And, you know, I got other people to listen to his stories, and then finally one day I tape recorded his stories, you know, I think I was in a supermarket lunch counter or something, and we tape recorded Jim talking about all of these experiences that he had. And but see, the thing is, he wasn't interested in working with this stuff because it had almost killed him, or something had almost killed him. He wasn't interested in using ozone to treat mine waste, or using ozone metals and all of that stuff to find out what was going on. And so I'd tell people about it, but you know, nobody ever, you know, it's hard to believe all of this stuff for one thing, and we didn't have anything to tie it to. And so about 5 years later, in 1995, a friend of mine that I'd taken over, a guy named Richard Haynes, I'd taken him over to meet Jim and hear Jim's stories about all of this back in 1990. I'd taken him to talk to Jim about it, and he'd heard about this guy named David Hudson. He sent me a tape that said David Hudson on it. And Richard's in Ayurvedic medicine. And I was doing environmental work, and I wasn't really paying too much attention to mystical stuff at the time, so I just kind of blew it off a bit, you know. But Richard called me after he'd sent me the tape about two or three weeks after he sent the tape, and said, "What do you think of the tape?" And I said, "I haven't listened to it," and I put it over. I'll listen to it right away. I put it over on the stereo and on the shelf, and then the stereo. And about a week later, Richard called and said, "What do you think of the tape?" And I said, "Well, I'm sorry, Richard. I haven't listened to it at all. I'll listen to it right away." And he said, "It's about what happened to Jim." I said, "Really? I'll listen to it right now." And it was David Hudson, and he was talking about this stuff that if you put your hand anywhere near it, it'd fly away from your hand. Well, that sounded like the same stuff that happened with Jim. And he said, "If you dry it out in the sunlight, it'll disappear in a flash of light." Well, Jim had been telling me the same thing back in 1989, 1990. So this stuff all had to be somehow related to the same thing. Well, so I thought, well, I've got to meet this guy, this David Hudson guy, and I called Richard and said, "Is there any way that I can, learn more from David Hudson?" And Richard said, "Oh, well, coincidentally, he's going to be here in Portland next month." So I saved my money and told Jim about all of this, and I even paid Jim's way, because Jim didn't have a good job at the time. And we went down and visited and saw David Hudson's lecture and workshop in Portland in I believe it was June of 1995. And all the way through the lecture, Jim was just nodding like everything made sense now. And so now Jim's knowledge about what this stuff is was sort of complete. I mean, not really complete, but at least he understood what it was, and he was no longer scared of it. And so he became interested in working with it. And David Hudson suggested that this stuff was a superconductor. And so Jim would take some that he'd made. Jim actually used ozone to convert gold into the white powder or into a green acid liquid. Or he'd do the same thing with rhodium or iridium. And his stuff was really, really powerful stuff. And I even have a video of some of the Ormus gold that Jim made that jumps away from a magnet, you know, just like jumps away from a magnetic field. And I guess the point I'm making here is that this is all a manifestation of something that I decided that I wanted when I was a kid. This is like my wildest science fiction fantasies as a kid. Here I am doing stuff that working with it. Since that time, I've worked with all of the people that are, you know, really, really making great discoveries in this field in one way or another. Chaz showed me how this stuff had teleported from the outside of a light bulb to the inside of a light bulb. Jim told me about that happening too. Teleportation, that's science fiction. But we're doing stuff that works with that. And levitation. Jim discovered sort of an anti-gravity effect with this stuff. Where if you move a magnet around under it, it'll jump away from the magnet. And then based on that, he designed the first magnetic trap to trap this out of water. And then as a result of that, we sort of got the suspicion that this magnetic water, this energized water that's spinning over a magnetic field, that water by itself might be good. And Bo Long has taken that idea and made his magnetic energizers. Basically, you shake this stuff up in a magnetic field and any water, and it's better if it's good water, you shake it up in a magnetic field, and it somehow energizes so that the Ormus effect is more powerful. And so we're finding, you know, almost on a weekly basis, making great new discoveries about this stuff. And here I am. I'm a college dropout, an unemployed college dropout, and I'm right in the middle of leading edge science. I mean, this is incredibly exciting, and it's all kind of the manifestation of what I decided that I wanted to do when I was a kid reading science fiction stories.
So what's Jim doing these days?
Jim is working for a mining company and helping them recover more of the precious metals from their ore, their source material.
You know, one thing you said that fascinated me is how did he use ozone to create white powder gold, starting with the metal?
Well,
ozone, the gas?
Yes, ozone, the gas. This is a very highly energetic, very special ozone. It's a very unusual ozone. And it would be really, really wonderful if we could get some more ozone generators that would do this. But right now, we're working, trying to get Jim to go ahead and build some more ozone generators. These ozone generators, we think that what the ozone does, maybe it's not O3, ozone's O3, but maybe it's O6 or O12 or something like that. we think that it surrounds the gold atom or the gold diatom or the rhodium.
How many atoms? I mean, how many of these atoms do you think you can get in a cluster?
I think it's a single unit. It may be a diatom unit or it may be an atom unit, but it's a single unit. And if it's a, it could be gold. If you add hydrogen to gold, so that you've fused gold with hydrogen, you have mercury. It could be monatomic mercury instead of monatomic gold, or it could be two golds, 279 electron units fused together, like in fusion, in cold fusion. We don't know for sure. There are some scientists that theorize that it might be possible to do that, and there might be a stable state of really, really heavy elements. Whatever it is, we think that these units, these atoms, have all of their electrons paired up, and that in that state, they're superconductors, and not only superconductors, but supercommunicators. They're quantum coherent resonators. They basically resonate with everything else everywhere else, every other atom of that type everywhere else. And they're really quite common in nature. So if you can get a bunch of them in a glass of water resonating together, then you freeze that water, you'll get the crystals that Masaru Emoto reported. That kind of thing, I think, is what we're seeing with the ormus, is that that there's ormus in all water, there's ormus in the air, there's ormus in the rock, there's ormus in the soil, there's ormus in all of the plants. But when you increase it, or increase its coherence, increase its communication ability by energizing it and uniformly energizing it, I think that that's what makes it work so well as a communicator. And I think that that's how it improves people's health and how it improves people's ability to manifest or be in the right place at the right time, or psychic abilities and all of those other things. We're sort of developing a unified field theory about ormus, a theory that includes all of these things into one theory about it. And I think that this is...
Listen, before you go on, I guarantee there's going to be a whole bunch of people who want to ask some questions. So rather than get into this too much, I'd like to ask if there's anyone who's got any questions. And while you're thinking about the kind of questions you want to ask, let me just say one thing that has just come to my attention lately. It's kind of like my topic of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, and I'd love some feedback about this too. I've seen lots and lots of examples of people who take lots and lots of ormus over a period of time, and they transform incredibly. And what's occurred to me now is that ormus has an accumulative effect. It's almost like a parabolic scale. The further you move along the line, the further a parabola starts going along to the right, and then it starts going up, and then it starts going up further, and then you further move along to the right, the higher it gets. And it seems like the more ormus you take over time and distance, the more advanced that people get. And I've had some very far out experiences with contacting people who have had ormus now for quite a while. And they're very far-out individuals, and it seems like ormus has an accumulative effect on people. I'd love to have any other comments on that. But in the meantime, any other questions you have for Barry Carter, or you want to address that? And if you want to speak up, remember, hit *7 and speak.
What, you have a question? What is your question?
I have a question, Barry. This is Eileen in Canada.
Hi.
Hi. As you know, Barry, I'm really, really interested and have been for several years now in the in more of the metaphysical.
Mm-hmm.
Interest. I have a metaphysical interest in Ormus, in addition to the physical.
Mm-hmm.
How you get it physically.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering if you could direct me to any kind of books or information that might lead me to more research in that area.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, I'm trying to get away from things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to get away from. I know that we produce Ormus in the pineal gland, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I'm really drawn to this.
Right, right. And you sent a question to me.
I was just reading Gabriel Cousins' book yesterday. His
mm-hmm.
new book on spiritual nutrition, and he has a short passage about iridium, but he has an excellent page in his book, Spiritual Nutrition, on how to have decent water,
mm-hmm.
using Victor Schauberger's stuff and using distilled water and salt, and et cetera. I just wanted to pass that on to everybody else if they're using water to trap Ormus. But my specific area of interest really is metaphysical, and I'm just wondering if you could direct me more into that area.
Well, here's what we're thinking, me and other people, a lot of other people that are working with Ormus. We're thinking that it serves as the connector between spirit and matter. Now, all matter ultimately is spirit, I believe. But it's, let's say, a little further removed from spirit than Ormus is. Ormus, the way Jim described it, he says it's like it has three legs. And ordinary metal has all three legs here in the physical. But Ormus has two legs here and one leg somewhere else. In the spirit, I guess, would be the way to put it. And Danae Harding, who makes the Spark of Life water, she adds to that. She says she thinks that her water has one leg here and two legs somewhere else. Now, you asked in the email that you sent, you asked whether there might be a way that we can make Ormus in our own body. And I think that the way I'd answer that question is, one thing that Jim discovered was using his magnetic trap, he was able to trap Ormus out of the air. He was able to literally spin air in his trap it by bubbling that air through water, and then convert that water into metal. And the metal he got was silver and copper with a little bit of gold. So that means that there's silver, Ormus silver, and Ormus copper, and Ormus gold in the air. Now, one of the metaphysical techniques that the Hindus talked about was something called pranayama, or yogic breathing. And what they do is they literally form a tight throat, or they direct the air through their nasal passages in a new way, and that traps prana out of the air. I think that prana and Ormus are the same thing. That the Ormus in the air, we can literally trap it out of the air using certain breathing techniques, just like Jim's air trap that traps the Ormus out of the air, only we don't have to convert it to metal. And just by breathing, we can pull it out of the air, and we can do that using techniques, breathing techniques. But we can also do that using intention, using our thoughts, using our the resonances we put out.
Barry, I also follow the work of Terrence McKenna.
Uh-huh.
And I absolutely love the man, and he talks a lot about the only place left is expanded states of consciousness for
mm-hmm.
trapping new visions
mm-hmm.
given the circumstances we are in right now on the planet. And I really think that there's a connection between expanded states of consciousness, finding another vision, light body, and Ormus.
Mm-hmm.
And I love what you said about the pranayama, because I'm actually learning how to do that right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think Ormus is the connector to the whole thing.
Yeah.
To the physical, to the spiritual, to the mental and emotional, to the energetic.
Mm-hmm.
It's very exciting, isn't it? But I think expanded states of consciousness have a lot to do with it.
There's another technique that Sieg Bird has been promoting, and that is sun gazing. Are you on his forum?
I'm not on his forum, but I'm very familiar with sun gazing.
Well, he's been talking about how he thinks that Ormus is created or encouraged or energized. We're not sure. But he thinks it's created by ingesting sunlight through the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm sure it has something to do with the pineal gland as well.
You bet. And I see that as a very good, strong possibility. See, what happens, I think, is that when you increase the amount of Ormus, there's three basic ways that Ormus can differ from other Ormus. Okay, it can be more concentrated, it can be more energized, and it can be informed. We can put information into it. Now, in some ways, we're talking about putting information into it when we talk about intending to get more Ormus through pranayama. That's putting intention into the Ormus we breathe in. We may also be energizing the Ormus and concentrating it that way. We may be literally trapping it. Now, the trap probably doesn't put information into the Ormus. It probably just energizes it and concentrates it. The chemical processes, I think they mostly just concentrate the Ormus. And then it's up to us, with intention, as Dennis talks about with his methods of making the Ormus at certain times of the month and of putting certain intention into it, Dennis can increase the effectiveness or the apparent effectiveness of the Ormus that he uses. So we can use all of these ways of changing the Ormus to change it in a way that's better for us. Now, there's another factor, too, and that is when you have more concentration of more energetic Ormus in the body, it seems to improve the connection between the cells and each cell with each other cell. So
it resonates in the shape, right?
Yeah. And so it's like you've got a cell phone in every cell. Okay, and you energize, you charge those cell phones up, and you repair the antennas. The antenna is the DNA, we think. And you repair the antenna, and you charge up that cell phone, then every cell is going to be able to talk to every other cell. Not only will they be able to talk to every other cell, they'll be able to talk to cells in your neighbors, too. We'll be in more harmony. In communication with ourselves and with everything around.
I can't wait, Barry, until we get to the point where we get past the individual experimentation. I mean, I know that that's what the forums are for, is to gather the community and discuss this.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't wait until there's a group of people that are actually taking the ormus in whatever which way they do it, whether they trap it physically or they can go into expanded states of consciousness and get it, you know, from their pineal gland. But I can't wait until the time comes and we get a circle of people together that actually are under the influence of, if you will, and then have a discussion.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Have a conversation influence of ormus.
Well, at that, and not just that, already there have been people who have meditated while taking ormus. And
I like to see the community, though. Like, it's time, you know, I'm feeling like 2012 is so close, and we I feel like, you know, like I said on the email, the veil's thin.
Mm-hmm.
So we can do a whole lot more today than we could do a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
I'd really like to see a bunch of people actually under the influence of it and discussing their vision.
Well, we're working on that, and we've
in order to put together another vision.
We've done it a few times with people who have been sampling Ormus products.
I'd love to hear about those conversations. Have you ever taped them or recorded them?
Some of them, yes. Yeah. When I was in doing a presentation in Cottonwood, Arizona, a month or so ago, Chaz, who makes the Priestess Alchemy product and who's also been one of the people on the conference call, Chaz brought some samples of some new stuff that he made, and everybody tried it. And boy, people were just sort of flying around there, you know. And it was a pretty energetic little conversation that we were having. And it was very, very interesting. And I did videotape people trying it and him demonstrating it and all of that. And yes, that's really a good reason to get together with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Another good reason is when you get together with other people, you can try different Ormus products and compare them with muscle testing or with, you know, just with conversation, you know, just comparing what your experience is with this one versus your experiences with that one. And if everybody brings a different product, everybody can try it. Several different products, you know, and it's just a good way to try things out. You can do muscle testing and other things like that. But I think one of the best things that I've heard of is that when people meditate, they take Ormus and meditate together, and Chaz told a story about this on tape. When they meditate together, they have an experience that is amazingly similar. Everybody has the same experience with it. It's like they're connected. And doing that while 10 people are hooked up to EEG would be just amazing, I think.
Mm-hmm.
If we could, you know, measure the coherence between different people all taking Ormus at the same time. We've measured when people take Ormus, within about 2 minutes, their brain hemispheres go into synchronization,
mm-hmm.
and they drop into an alpha state. And within about 10 minutes, they drop into a theta-delta state, which is the deepest state of meditation, and their front brain and their rear brain synchronize. Now, that is amazing. This is, you know, that state, that theta-delta state is what these gurus sitting in the mountains in a cave somewhere spend 30 years getting to the point where they can do that and be conscious and have a conversation.
And do spontaneous healing.
Yeah. And people do that automatically within 10 minutes of ingesting most of the Ormus products, and they don't even know it.
So you know, you can ingest the Ormus, and you could also put yourself into an expanded state of consciousness and evoke your own Ormus, what the yogis call, I think they call it nectar.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now listen, let me interrupt here because we've explored that subject quite a bit, and I know there are going to be lots of other questions that people had.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I have a question for Barry.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever done any experimentation in parting with pH? In, for example, if you took some off at, say, 9.5 and some off at 10 and some off at 10.2, et cetera, or after the plateaus?
That is really a good experiment, and I've never done it, and I don't know anybody that has ever done it, but I'd
really
like to
see somebody
do it.
Well, I'm halfway through it now.
Huh?
Would you explain that again for us?
Okay, what I've done, I'm taking some of my Vortex Ocean Whirlpool water, and I've noticed some different things about it, but the one thing I have noticed is that it produces a whole whack more precipitate than the surrounding water does. So I was thinking about one of the things that I noticed was that when I'm adding the sodium hydroxide to it, and there's plateaus, I get to if I get it to 10.7 and then I let it sit for a while, it starts to creep up on me. So I started stopping it a little earlier, and I noticed that I was even at 9.6, I was getting a whole bunch of precipitate. So being in a rush one day, I took the water off at 9.6 and saved the water, and then I started dripping a bit more lye in, and sure enough, there's more precipitate there. So I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to see what the stuff that comes down first does compared to the stuff that comes down second? So I'm looking for a way to compare the two and see exactly which is which and what it does and et cetera. And I'm going to try energizing each of them separately and see what they do there. And I've got several other experiments planned. I got quite a lot of it, so I can play with it a bit.
You
but,
bet.
My point, though, was that I was going to try and see if maybe, you know, the gold comes down first or something else comes down first, and maybe one of them is richer in another thing, depending on where it comes down from pH. I mean, I know that the Gilchrist metals don't start coming down till 10.8 and change, so
right.
Obviously there's differentiation there, and that's how we keep it clean, you know. But
mm-hmm.
I believe that there might be a... particularly at the plateaus, where you can't seem to make the pH come up, even if you really run the stuff in a hurry,
mm-hmm.
there's probably something particular about those plateaus that when you hit them, you know, you're taking one thing out of the seawater. So that's what I've been doing, and I'm. I'll get my results to you. Also, I'm having a few computer problems right now. This is another thing that I was going to ask Barry. It seems like when I get started making a whole lot of Ormus down here, I have electronic problems going crazy here. Last week, I blew up two monitors, a printer, and had some problems with the memory in my computer. I just can't keep the thing running.
How far away is your computer from your experimental place?
Right now, it's on the opposite side of about a 16 to 18 foot room, but it was
in
a little
closer. Room.
Yeah, it needs to be moved completely out of this room. I can't keep the damn thing running.
yes. Keep them in separate rooms for sure. And it wouldn't hurt to put up some foil wall board or something, foil back.
Yeah,
wall
I've
board
thought of that like too. The problem is that I've got it's my. My computer is my right hand. I use it for recording results. I use it for video, videoing stuff that I'm doing and taking
mm-hmm.
pictures and all that stuff. And it's kind of so I've got to figure out some way to isolate the field from the Ormus and the Ormus from the field. I think
yes, you
because
do.
It's definitely having an effect, and it's getting pretty profound. It's starting to hit me where it hurts in the checkbook, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
And the monitors, that was the real new one for me. I didn't think that I thought these are old CRT monitors, and they're pretty tough, but
mm-hmm.
not a problem. Just pops them right out. Both
well, I'll tell you that the effect here might not be the power of the Ormus. It might be what's happening to you.
I thought of
now,
that, too.
I've had some experience with this, and I remember a metaphysician that I studied with about 20 years ago used to consistently say that when he sort of got to higher states, all the electronics around him would blow out consistently.
Yes.
And I thought, oh yeah, well, you know, he's a bit of a strange dude. But I actually experienced that myself when I was doing some fairly far out stuff I started dousing the levels of consciousness of the Ormus state minerals, and I got so far out with such expanded states with doing that I was doing it with Dr. Jen, and both of us could hardly even function. We couldn't even remember what number we were up to. And what happened was I had two different mobile phones, you know, two different accounts and so on, and both of them wouldn't work. Both of them wouldn't pick up. Both of them would act as if they were out of range or just couldn't function. And I would ring up customer service, and I kept breaking up with customer service, and my electronics around me just started going sideways on me. That's the point that I'm saying, is that unless you are grounded, here's the point that I'm getting to, unless you keep getting grounded and get your feet on grass or on sand or on dirt and wander around in sand and dirt for a few minutes, if you get too ungrounded, your electronics around you will pop out.
Yeah, I believe that, and that already occurred to me. And for a while there, I was wearing a ground strap around my wrist and had it bolted right onto the case of my CPU, and that didn't help.
Well, you got to get grounded to earth.
Yeah,
with your feet.
I know. I gotta have to take my computer outside somewhere, I guess.
I heard that there was water every so often. I heard that there was a Russian experiment that they took an egg and put two cell phones next to it and cooked the egg. Well, maybe it's possible that an egghead can cook a cell phone.
Yeah. A good one, Barry.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm rather suspicious of that, because I have been having more than my fair share of grief and anything electronic that I have to deal with. I'm taken from watching the television from quite a long way away now, because I didn't want to interrupt my father's programming, but I've even had a bit of trouble with that. You know, it's one of those new ones with high def.
Can I inject one thing? This is Tim. There is a possibility. I agree with the fact that it's probably not more the room, but it's more you that's affecting it. Another thing to do, though, is to speak to your room and to your products that you use. Remind them they're tools for your spirit, and sanctify them for the use that you intend to do. One of the things that electronics does is it has a connection to things that can defile your spirit. And when you allow that connection into the room, especially with the Ormus, you are mixing things that cannot mix right, and something will blow. So Danae reminded us that when she talked about her device won't make the water if someone walks in the room that has some defilement in their spirit.
I gotcha.
And so speak to it with your intention, with your heart, and sanctify it. Just remind it. Remind those things. They're tools that you need. You need them to function properly. But then you're going to have to watch what they're used for or what can get connected or through them to keep defilement from the outside from coming into them. Especially with a computer, that's true nowadays. Even if you do everything to try to keep that, there's always some things that can. Part of cleaning up our spirit is what Ormus' purpose is, and it will have the same effect on the earth or on anything it comes into contact with. It'll shut it down if it can't clean it up. And that's why becoming holy, becoming more spiritual, is part of this process.
That's a great thought. That sounds like a Sikh Virta thought.
Yeah.
Can I also say something? Holy is like whole, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, holy means to be whole, W-H-O. You know, it's like I am complete. There's something, there's a big hole in us that is supposed to be spiritual, and that's what most of us are rediscovering.
Well, that's why I want to make a water product, or get somebody to make a water product and call it WHOLLY water.
Well, I'd do that. I think that's great. I like that idea.
I just wanted to also add something. If you want to be grounded, spiritually grounded, you can visualize a white light coming through the center of your head, moving through the center of your body, and grounding down into the earth, as opposed to using a wire connecting something electronically. You can visualize your spiritual energy coming through the center of your body, the universal energy coming down and connecting into the earth.
Well, that's a good point, too, because if you go look at a lot of the ancient texts, though, they didn't have electronic wiring, but they would go to considerable effort with a holy place, not just to sanctify themselves, but to sanctify the place and all of the instruments, tools, bowls, anything that was going to be used in that spot would be anointed and be used in through some kind of ritual that sanctified it. What's true for you is true for everything you use.
Well, here's a story that a guy told me when I was last time I was in Austin, Texas. A gentleman came to the presentation there, and he said that he'd been taking Ormus for a while and was really kind of into it, and somebody called him at the office and really pissed him off. And he got really, really, really angry at this guy, and then sparks started jumping, literally, from his hands to the keyboard. And he couldn't use the keyboard. And then they started jumping to the telephone, and he had to quit talking to the guy. And then that pissed him off more, and so he had to leave the room because everybody else in the room, their computers were having problems. And so as he walked out the door, sparks jumped from his shoulders to the frame of the door, which was a steel frame. Now, my theory about this is that Ormus increases your energy, but your energy has to be balanced. And if it's imbalanced, it still can increase that energy. It tends to increase the balance, but it doesn't steal your free will. You can still get out of balance if you choose to. And I never have any problems with static electricity anymore. I live in a dry place, and I always used to have problems with it. I don't have any problems with it anymore. And I'm surrounded with electronics, and I don't zap anything. So I think that as you get more balanced with this, as you balance the energies, the problems will start to dissipate.
I have a question.
Oh, sounds like good advice.
Thank you. What's the question? You're aware of Victor Schalke. You mentioned Ormus. You have three states, a concentrated, energized, and informed.
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me of Victor's fructogens, dynagens, and phologens.
Mm-hmm.
That the whole universe is made of.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see the same relation? Like fructogens would be concentrated matter, dynagens, energized matter,
mm-hmm.
and phologens would be the informed matter.
You bet. The direct correlation.
So the Ormus then is the same thing as that, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And the technologies he's talking about are directly related to, like, magnetic compression and such.
We're not sure.
Are those Ormus-type technologies?
Pardon?
Would those be considered Ormus technologies? Like,
I would venture a guess that they would, but we don't have any direct experimental proof of that. But I would guess that it would be yes.
Okay, and just some anecdotal regarding like the body. producing electromagnetic field through rage and anger. Anybody on Ormus, I agree, if they have these concentrated, energized fields within them, and they charge them with their intense of anger and rage, I've seen it, you know, through people I've worked with and given Ormus. I'm an IT engineer, so lots of computers, and yeah, certain people just had things break a lot, and to people that got mad and angry. And my own life, you know, I've noticed through yoga, you know, pranayama, and meditation, just, yeah, I don't have, my electronics work well for me, and life works well, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the quality in your intent that you put in.
Here's something fascinating that I'd like to add that was quite an amazing discovery for me.
Yeah.
I for the last few years, I've had a Mac iBook, which has been incredibly stable. It's just taken everything I could dish out. And I've had it for, you know, 2 or 3 years now. I've always been very careful about, because I've got a couple of computers in my office, and I'm always very careful about not having Ormus in my office, because the computers tend to affect it. And sometimes I've actually inadvertently put some computers, some Ormus down next to a computer, and it's almost like I've heard it crying out to me to be moved. My attention just keeps coming to it, like, move me! So I move it away, and well, one time I stuck some of Danae's Ormus next to my Mac laptop, my indestructible Mac laptop, and it killed it. Now, here's the thing. It didn't kill the Ormus.
Mm.
The Ormus overpowered the laptop.
Oh, yeah.
I had to replace the hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's unprecedented. Holy crap. How strong is that Ormus? That you see clearly, Ormus and computers don't get on, but usually the computers overpower the Ormus. But this was Danae's Ormus overpowered the computer. How about that? I mean, there's something in there that I don't quite know what to make of it. But the thing is, I always keep my Ormus away from computers these days.
Well, I can relate another experience, too.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Hello. This is Siegfurter.
I thought so. Hi, buddy.
How are you doing?
I was thinking only moments ago. I was thinking, Siegfurter.
Well,
how can we never hear Siegfurter anymore? It's good to hear
Well,
you.
I've been here. I've just been listening. I've been silent. But I can relate a story about working with Rhodium. One day I was working in my lab, and I have a television in there, and I also have a number of jars. And as the refinement and dropping down of the of the rhodium was occurring, all of a sudden everything cracked. And I don't know exactly. I haven't yet been able to figure out why that happened, but there was some kind of a frequency related to the rhodium as I was working with the rhodium. It fried the electronics in the remote controls.
Mm-hmm.
It fried the electronics in the television set.
Mm-hmm.
And it also cracked glass.
Mm-hmm.
So with some of these materials, you have to be quite careful, because I don't know what that stuff was putting out, but it was enough to shatter glass.
Right.
I don't know if anybody else has had any experiences like that, but
Jim's early experiences, he was using a hot plate to heat up this Ormus as he was working with it, and he found that he couldn't keep the glass intact. Then he started putting a table saw blade or a skill saw blade on top of the hot plate. And that seemed to give it enough shielding that he could still heat it without it tunneling out through the glass.
Well, that may be something I'll have to try. But I was also using a hot plate.
Mm-hmm.
It got to a certain stage. I was, you know, warming up the solution.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, I just heard stuff cracking all around me. And I looked in the, you know, the vessels all around were cracking. And so this is some pretty powerful stuff. I mean, some that were, you know, 10 feet away. So,
Had some Ormus that he made. He called it the hot rock stuff. It was made from rock, and he had it sitting out in the sunshine. And I actually visited him, and I noticed this bottle that was half a bottle, the bottom half of the bottle with this liquid in it. And I said, "What happened?" He said, well, after it'd sit there for a while, the Ormus would tunnel out through the side. But most of it would tunnel out even with the liquid level. And so some of it wouldn't make it all the way through the glass. And it would rematerialize inside the glass, causing fractures in the glass. So when I went to pick up the whole bottle, the top half of the jar of the jug came up, and the bottom half was still there. This was like a gallon.
Well, that makes sense because
orange.
That makes sense because I've had that same tunneling effect. I mean, it's like the stuff somehow gets on the outside of the glass.
You bet.
It goes right through it.
You bet. And
I was going to also make a comment about when people wreck things with their attitude or their intention. You know, I do a lot of work with the sun, and one area that we haven't covered on the Ormus and Sun Gazing Forum yet is there is a dark sun, and it's called Talos,
mm-hmm.
and the ancients were quite familiar with it. There's a light or white sun, and there's a dark sun,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of times it's attitudinal as to how that sun light will come to you. And sometimes if we're not in tune or if we're not grounded, we're getting a dark force. And so we have to be sure that we are grounded. And otherwise, we can be overcome, I'll say, with too much of the dark side of the sun. And the sun, I believe, is what produces the Ormus in the air. So the kind of Ormus that we would be breathing in is very much in tune with our attitude and with our intention. And so, you know, I mean, we've talked a lot about that from time to time, but I still don't think people realize how much they influence their environment by their intention.
Yeah.
And so it's something that we all should be more careful with.
Well, I've found that if you hold things too rigidly, like the glass is a rigid thing designed
mm-hmm.
to resist change, and you hold things too rigidly, that they break, they shatter, and the way I say that is either shift happens or shit happens.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You've got to allow for change, and in the design of your systems, be ready to change them so that you can get away from breakage. You can get away from, you know.
Well, we can also hold our belief.
Rigid thing you do that will allow something to change and
Our beliefs can be too rigid, too.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
And those rigid beliefs can get shattered.
Yeah.
And it's all about our attitude towards it.
Yeah.
I like to say that, you know, everything is okay, and nothing is okay, and everything is right, and nothing is right.
Mm-hmm.
You can get too hung up on either side of it.
I have a question for
yes.
I'm sorry. I have a question for whoever might want to feel guided to respond. I have Lyme disease, and of course that's a rather disturbing parasite, and I've been taking Ormus for about 6 months. First few months I felt much, much better, had more wind, more energy generally, but now it's kind of reversed itself. I'm getting much worse. I quit taking the Ormus and then started again a while ago. But now I'm concerned, boy, you know, unless I'm really clear in my head and what my intention is with this stuff, what am I doing? Am I feeding the general health of the parasites, or am I feeding my general wholeness and healthy self-correcting mechanisms within my cell and my cells and my genetic material? So how do you sort that one out and figure whether you're nourishing the parasites or nourishing yourself?
Are you familiar with the concept of the healing crisis?
Yes.
And you pretty much think that that's not what's happening?
Well, I mean, it could be a healing crisis, but it's certainly a difficult one of long standing.
Uh-huh. Well, sometimes it can. I mean, it's taken a long time to get there, and it may take a long time, not as long, but a while to get back through. Another thing is that sometimes you can slow down a healing crisis by reducing the dose or taking a different product. I think that it works better for you than it works for the Lyme disease. I think that it's more beneficial for the antibodies and the systems in the body that help the healing than it is for whatever disease is in there. That's been the experience that's been pretty much universally reported.
All right.
And another thing that you can think about is making sure that you keep your body alkaline. Sigverta, do you have any ideas?
Well, I'm not that familiar with Lyme disease, other than this is a parasite. I think we can think about it too often. I think if we think about our illness rather than wellness, then we may promote its growth. So it's very important that every morning when we get up, we have to say the thoughts of wellness, heal my body, or be conscious that we want to be well. And, without mentioning any particular malady or disease that we have, I think we can have a great influence over our health attitudinally.
Rice therapy has also been shown to be very effective with Lyme disease.
Thomas, hi.
Hi there.
What was that again, Thomas?
Using a rice frequency generator, is that what you're talking about?
Yes, sir. There's several different rice forums on Yahoo, but there's rice frequency generators, in particular light tubes. I have a Biotech 2000, and you can set it according to certain frequencies. And there's a set of frequencies that's pretty well known for Lyme disease, and it's one of the most known to be one of the most effectively treated with rice.
Didn't work for me. I built my own and tried it for a number of months, and just couldn't get anything out of it. But I have heard that too.
Well, in a way, I think it's a way of focusing intention. And to actually sit there on the machine and to program the frequencies in as well as use the Ormus. Perhaps in combination with the Ormus it would work somewhat better.
Hmm. Haven't tried that.
Thank you. And be real gentle with that, because I've heard of people taking Ormus and doing the right frequencies and getting way out of proportion results. So go into it real slow, and maybe cut back on the Ormus a bit before you do it.
Yeah, notice the Ormus tends to speed things up.
I have a question about radiation.
Anyone else want to ask any questions of Barry?
You have a question about what?
Radiation.
Uh-huh.
I've heard some reports about having to be careful with radiation under certain circumstances, that it can be produced from the ormus, or one of the experiments I've tried to do, one of the ways to verify ormus content, obviously, is to convert it to metal, and I sort of suspect that's where some of the these reports about radiation are coming from, that when you try to convert it to metal, it can produce radiation. Is that correct?
That's what we believe, yes. Now, here's an interesting thing. Danae Harding was working, Danae and her son were working on their machine, and they were working with the guy that is, you know, the first built one after the original fellow left it at the mine. And this machine, when they ran it without, when they were working around it, they got sicker and sicker and sicker. And they realized eventually that it was kind of a radiation sickness. So they took a Geiger counter and measured just, you know, off the scale radiation. They wrapped the Geiger counter in lead, and it was still off the scale. And they tried all kinds of things, and then it hit Danae that maybe it's orgone radiation or something else. And so they wrapped the Geiger counter in aluminum foil, and it stopped the radiation. And it didn't take that much foil. So this was definitely a different kind of radiation, but it was still registering on the Geiger counter, and it seemed to be as strong as, you know, like gamma radiation. I mean, it was really powerful radiation. Once they put the machine in this shielded, aluminum shielded container, basically they didn't have any more problems with the radiation. Now, Jim also noticed when he was working with this stuff that wrapping it in foil would help. It seemed to keep it more energetic inside, and it seemed to keep outside energies from causing those inside energies to dissipate. And this is just, you know, purely anecdotal speculation, but we think maybe that there is some kind of a field, a radiation field, an energy field that this aluminum shields the ormus from. And that's why several of the ormus producers ship their product in foil or aluminum containers. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, sort of. right. Well, I've done a lot of work with orgone, so I understand, you know, a lot of the weird things that can happen with it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the really interesting things...
It's a fascinating subject, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
That whole orgone thing?
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, finish.
Well, that it will... you can generate material. I think part of what Danae was saying, too, her process, she's getting tons and tons of gold out in her gold water without actually expending any, and that's through orgone actually manifesting as gold in the water. Although it's not metallic gold, it's the kind of the homeopathic version of it, but which turns into it turns into real material when it obtains the right energies and electrons, basically. My theory on that is that the orgone is the collapsed hydrogen atoms, or the hydrinos, and when they obtain the right energy, they expand back up to normal size. But before that happens, they can sort of cluster together. I believe this is what the memory is in the water, because water has a great affinity for this material. When the water is exposed to, well, the orgone is exposed to whatever frequencies, can be a material or an herb or whatever, it clusters to to sort of match those frequencies, and then when it obtains the energies it needs to expand up into what we could observe as a material, then it can produce gold or silver or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a similar theory that I've been working on for a long time, and that is that the ormus hangs out inside of water molecules. Jim found that the ormus likes to hide out in tight places. Well, inside of a water molecule is a nice tight place. And it hangs out and resonates there. And the resonance is like the resonance that you, when you put sand on a metal plate and put a speaker under the plate and vibrate the plate, you get these patterns on the plate, like with cymatics. Have you seen any of those videos and stuff?
Yes.
Yeah. And it vibrates the, let's say, the field, the structure of space, and the water molecules, the elements, the hydrogen and the oxygen, will fit into that matrix, that vibrational nodes of vibration, and they will tend to congregate in a certain pattern around that vibrating ormus transducer inside the water molecule. The ormus transducer is quantum coherent, connected to all of the other ormus molecules in there, and, or ormus atoms or whatever they are, and it therefore causes that water molecule to form a shape going from an icosahedron to a dodecahedron to a collapsed icosahedron and so on. And those different shapes, when you freeze them, you get Masaru Emoto's crystal ice formations, you know, snowflake pattern ice formations. And all of that is because of this resonant, sort of like a radio inside each and every water molecule. And that universal or near universal resonance of that ormus inside these water molecules carries a lot of the information that biological systems use to operate. I mean, we're mostly water. Does that make sense?
Sure, yeah.
Barry?
Yeah.
It's Arlene. While you guys were just having that discussion, I had this thought come into my head, and I was wondering if anyone has ever used sound frequencies with also light frequencies to speed up the molecules while you're creating and working with the ormus.
Some people have talked about this, and one gentleman who's a musician came and visited me here, and he tried to come up with some frequencies for the different ormus elements. I had some pure ormus elements here, and he came up with a bunch of frequencies that he felt were appropriate for working with them, and I think he recorded them or something somewhere. I'm not sure what happened to them. But at any rate, I think that it's probably a good way to program the water molecules and the ormus in the water molecules. You can put frequency in with thought. You can put it in with sound. You can put it in with light. Now, in terms of sun gazing and in terms of the effect of light on ormus, I think that light and sunlight and high energy radiation, all of these things energize the ormus up to a certain point. And at that point, that's called superconductors are superconductors until they get too much energy in them. And that point is called HC2. And when they reach that high energy level, the Cooper pairs that keep the superconductor superconducting, break apart, and it quits being a superconductor. So, in other words, heating them on an electric burner can be beneficial to a point and then detrimental. Putting them in the sunlight can be beneficial to a point, then detrimental. Exposing them to a very energetic sound source may be beneficial to a point and then detrimental. Exposing them to magnetic fields, beneficial to a point and then detrimental. You want to rev it up as much as you can without breaking those Cooper pairs and causing it to drop to metal or drop toward metal. And I think that that's the thing that Jim, in his early experiments, once he realized what was going on with this stuff, that's one of the things that he demonstrated. And he's very successful in converting formus to metal because he's figured out a lot of these things about how to run it up to that point and then drop it. And other things that you can add into it so that when it drops toward metal, it will catch on to something and form a metal-metal bond. So the idea there
is... Here's a fascinating question I have for the whole group, especially Barry and Sigverta. There's this idea that Ormus likes or doesn't like light. And it seems like Barry and Sigverta seem to be on the other end of the spectrum in relation to that. And I'd love your viewpoints on that because I know one time Sigverta made a couple of comments about how when your Ormus is getting a bit lifeless, a few hours in direct sunlight will recharge it. There's been an idea that when you make Ormus, you should keep it in the dark. So I would like to hear a couple of viewpoints on that because I was growing up with the idea of you just keep your Ormus in the dark. And so, listen,
that's basically what I just said, Dennis. Dennis?
Yeah.
Basically what I just said is that up to a certain point, it's beneficial. But we don't know where that point is, and we don't know how to measure where that point is. So we have to intuit where that point is. And some people are going to be better at that than others. So my recommendation is be very careful. Don't put it in the light and keep it in the dark as much as you can. If you know when it is moving, is likely to move toward metal by being exposed to high energy ultraviolet, then more power to you. Great. Sigverta, do you have some ideas, thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with you that up to a point, it will charge it. I never suggested that leaving it out there all the time. It's just like if you take regular water out into the direct sunlight, it will also charge it. Mm-hmm. Sun-charged water is a staple for certain religious groups. And so, I mean, it's a known fact that the direct sunlight will, in fact, enhance the water. You know, you and I have not always agreed on that point, but I think over the years that we've been discussing these things, we both may be right in that sunlight does enhance Ormus up to a point. I've always only suggested take it out into direct sunlight for a couple of hours, mm-hmm. and then take it back inside. I have Ormus that I have kept in a lighted room most of the time and never in the dark, and it seems to hold up. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can charge it and recharge it and charge it and recharge it as it tends to lose its veracity. Mm-hmm. So to a point, sunlight will charge it. But I've never had the experience of any of it ever changing to a metal because it was left in the sunlight too long. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that's an actual fact.
Jim had that experience quite a bit. And one thing that Jim noticed, and this is going to be apropos to your product as well, he noticed that salt seems to keep it from being responsive to magnetic fields, to strong magnetic fields or to high-energy radiation. That salt protects it.
Was Jim using sunlight UVA, or was he using some artificial?
No, he used serious pulse magnetic fields.
Okay, well I think that's quite a bit different.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think sunlight is a refining substance. Mm-hmm. I think it refines things. I don't think it makes them coarser, which a metal would be compared to ormus.
Mm-hmm.
My experience with sunlight is that whatever is exposed to sunlight will be further refined, mm-hmm. rather than whatever the opposite of refined is, more coarse.
Mm-hmm. I know that the Essene literally put his seawater precipitate out in the sunshine and left it there for days,
mm-hmm.
and swept the top layer off, mixed it with sulfur, and cooked it in a reverberatory furnace and made metal. And he showed me metal that he'd made that way.
What did he add to it?
Sulfur.
Sulfur? Any nitrogen at all?
No, he didn't. He just, I think it was just sulfur, sulfate.
I guess this is something we still need to study a bit on. But
absolutely.
Barry, can I just say something here?
Sure.
The work of Victor Schauberger, he talks, I mean, his label is the father of forestry and the water wizard.
Mm-hmm.
When you understand the properties of water, I do remember reading that sunlight does not empower water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he talks a lot about that. So the idea that sunlight makes something better, even though the word refined doesn't mean better, the more I understand how water works through the works of Victor Schauberger, the more I understand how energy works.
Mm-hmm.
This is Tim. Let me inject something right there, too, on Schauberger. His theories were based more on the temperature. And the reason why sunlight had a negative effect is as the water would move downstream, it would come out of the shaded areas or out of the enclosed rock areas. And when it got above 39 degrees, that's when it became dead water, in his opinion. I think the sunlight actually still charges the ormus in the shade, but it is the temperature that may have as much of an effect on the dropping into metal that Sigvertus was talking about, and the sun itself may not have that negative effect if that temperature is kept correct.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, this is an area where we need to do a lot of research. And
well, what I have found, Barry, is that, you know, we get our product or our source material from a very high area. I mean, it's 13,000 feet, and it's kind of like a salt plain with a pond or a lake in the middle. And this stuff in the summertime is under, I mean, at that altitude, it's under extreme sun.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it will. Hello?
Hello.
We will drop you
anyway,
for a moment.
What I'm saying is, I believe that ormus collects ormus, and that the ormus already in some of the salt or some of the salt water, that it also collects more from the sun, from the sunlight. I believe the ultimate source of all ormus is the sun.
That's quite possible. And
so I don't think that the sun is anything damaging to its own offspring.
And we know
I think
that
it just enhances it.
We know that Ormus is in the air in Las Vegas. Because
yes.
Jim has trapped it out, and the air is definitely exposed to a lot of UV sunlight in Las Vegas.
Yes.
Or lost wages, as I call it.
Yeah, lost wages. Me too.
Okay.
You just said something really, really instructing, Sigverda, and that is that Ormus collects Ormus.
Yes.
And another way of saying that in real life is birds of a feather flock together.
That's right.
And, but you know,
and another way of saying that is that the more Ormus you take, the more Ormus you are, the more Ormus you create. Therefore, it goes back to something that I sort of penned on the forums about a year ago, that and someone just had some contest with it, which was you make Ormus and it's got a higher frequency than your last lot, and that in turn lifts you. And so the next lot you make is even stronger.
There you go.
Ormus collects Ormus.
Well, that can also be said about sun gazing.
Mm-hmm.
Every time you sun gaze, you become a better receptor. And your body will eventually get to the point where it can actually collect the sun, the Ormus out of the air.
Now this is the basis of Mountain Manna. Doug Schmidt, who makes the Mountain Manna product, he actually uses what he calls, or we call, a mass attraction trap. Basically, he has the Ormus, and he uses it as an attractor for more Ormus. And that's how the theoretical way that his trap works. Now, that hasn't been scientifically confirmed, but he does definitely have a good, high-quality Ormus product. And
well, I think that's exactly what happens in these high mountain lakes in the Himalayas.
Well, that
you know, the air is a bit purer up there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as dense. And in the summertime, this is in the southern prefecture of the Gobi Desert. And so it's extremely hot and dry.
Mm-hmm.
And so I believe that the Ormus that's already collected is constantly collecting more Ormus, which makes the salt from that region, it seems to me to be a bit more prolific in Ormus than some of the other salts, even the sea salt.
Oh, yeah.
I did an experiment with a homeopath where we took Celtic sea salt and we strobed it with a very powerful xenon strobe light in a box of mirrors for months.
Mm-hmm.
And it was growing crystals out of thin air.
Wow.
And and basically what's causing the Ormus to build more Ormus, again, is the dark matter, the collapsed hydrogen, whatever. Crystals are already, you know, in a crystalline form, the frequencies are there. And the, for instance, in our experiment, your strobe light is putting out an extremely powerful electromagnetic pulse. But as well as the light, which, as most people know, when a photon is absorbed, it releases an electron. And so it was getting both energy, you know, in several forms, and I believe, again, it was the orgone that was causing these crystals to grow, but these crystals afterwards were so powerful. I mean, you could take, like, the equivalent of two or three salt grains from your salt shaker, that equivalent amount was enough to give you a very potent effect when you took it orally. It was very similar to the Ormus in larger quantities that I'm taking now. So it was, I believe we had highly, highly concentrated the Ormus content in our salt to the extreme. And we also began to find crystals.
Now, whether you concentrated it or energized it, that's the question that we need to ask. We need to find out. But
well, I think that's an example of spirit into matter.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, there's a very thin veil between spirit and matter. And if you reach the right frequency, then it's not difficult to transition to either side. If you if you reach that ideal point.
Jim,
we
called this.
We began to find some crystals that had what appeared to be metallic compounds and colored specks of colored material in some of the crystals, which appeared to be metallic in nature.
Jim, back in 96, told me that if you put Ormus out and it's energetic stuff, the stuff that he made using ozone, that it becomes a getter. And that's the word he used, is a getter. That will actually pull more Ormus in. And one example he gave of that was he had a stack of microscope slides, and he would put this in his pocket, and over time these microscope slides would become totally opaque because the Ormus would get in between these slides in these tight places in between the slides and fill it up and make it totally so you couldn't see through it. And he used this as his exposure meter, because he didn't want to get back to the place where he was sleeping 22 hours a day. And Joe also had a bottle of aluminum oxide desiccant beads. It was a sealed bottle. And he would put that inside his storage container that was a magnetically shielded box, basically, and in there with his high-energy Ormus. And this sealed bottle of aluminum oxide desiccant beads would get heavier and heavier and heavier. And he took it out one time and opened it up and put a magnet under it and moved the magnet around under it and had me give a whiff of it. But he said he'd already done that before for another guy. And the other guy was a kickboxer. And he was an electrician, and several years before he'd been in a kickboxing match out in the dirt, you know, and his opponent had come in at an angle and hit him and broken his leg, and he jammed the end of the broken bone, the lower leg, jammed it into the dirt, and the doctor said, "We're not going to be able to recover your, you're going to lose your leg." And he said, if you take my leg, I'll kill myself. I will not live without a leg. And so the doctor pinned it together, but he was always in continuous pain. He was always walked with a limp. Well, Jim gave him this, and he developed bone cancer in that leg. Well, Jim had this fresh bottle of aluminum oxide desiccant beads that had somehow teleported Ormus into him. I mean, the Ormus had gotten in there all by itself, going in there to hide out or something. It kind of likes to hide out. It will, and I think that might be the principle that makes certain things like salt, which protects it from magnetic field, an attractor for the Ormus. And it gets in there, and it got into this bottle, and the Jim took the lid off, and this was a sealed bottle, and took the lid off and peeled the seal back and moved the magnet under it and had the guy take a whiff of it. And on the way back from, this was in a shop building, and on the way back up to the house, he said he saw himself walking from 2 feet up or 5 feet up and 2 feet behind. He had an out-of-body experience. He saw himself walking up the hill just from one whiff of this stuff. And 2 weeks later, he called Jim and said, "My leg is really hurting. It feels like it hurt. It feels like it felt when I first broke it. It's a dull ache, but it's really intense." And he said, "What's going on?" And Jim didn't have any idea what was going on. And a month later, he called Jim and said, guess what? My partner the other day noticed I wasn't limping anymore. He was an electrician. He noticed he wasn't limping anymore. And so I went to my oncologist. He was, you know, said he had bone cancer. I just went to his cancer doctor and had him do an examination of the leg. They did an X-ray, and they couldn't find any evidence of bone cancer in that leg. Furthermore, they couldn't find any evidence that the leg had ever been broken, because when there's a break, there's this callus that forms around the break, and that wasn't there. Literally, one whiff of this really energetic ormus that was trapped, that was pulled, that was attracted inside these aluminum oxide desiccant beads. And then Jim moved the magnet under it and gave him a whiff of this stuff. One whiff.
Have you done any experiments with that aluminum oxide desiccant as a result of that?
I have some of the aluminum oxide desiccant beads out in the same container that Jim had this material in. I have some of Jim's material out there. It's out in the garage. It's all dusty and dirty, but I have a bottle of mineral oil out there. Mineral oil gets all cloudy from the ormus getting into it, even though it's a sealed bottle. I have pictures of the cloudiness in the mineral bottle on the website. I have pictures of the aluminum oxide desiccant beads. But I haven't tried that experiment because I think that the ormus out there isn't as energetic as it once was. It's been there for 10 years.
That sounds like something we should do.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We need to do some experiments.
I've got some of that desiccant around here. I'm going to try that.
Yeah, yeah. Put it in your storage unit. Put it in Jim uses a steel file cabinet, and puts a magnet on the outside so that it can't get out, and it's going to go and find a good tight place where it can go and hide out.
Is it what's the nature of the bottle that you keep the desiccant in?
And you just buy a brand new bottle, and it's a sealed bottle.
I mean, is it plastic?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, it's plastic.
Yep. It's kind of like one of these peanut butter bottles, plastic peanut butter bottle with this little plastic thing you peel off the top and then.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Because that sounds like something we ought to try if that stuff works like that.
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
One of the
first time I've heard. First time I've heard that story.
This is a story I tell in all my workshops.
Okay,
but
well, unfortunately, I've never been able to attend one.
Well, clearly, you know, we've been missing out.
Yes. Yes.
One of the things I'm going to try is to energize the salt with the strobe unit and then drop the ormus out of it.
Oh yes.
And that way, see, the salt will maintain the stability of the ormus while it's being energized. And then should have highly energized ormus when I drop it out of the solution.
Mm-hmm. Worth an experiment.
Could you say again what was in the container that you strobed?
Oh, just Celtic sea salt.
Beer?
Just salt, Celtic sea salt. Right.
And beer? What kind of beer?
No, it was, they were just dry crystals.
I don't think beer had anything to do with
it. It was a box of mirrors that maintain, you know, the light bouncing around inside of it.
Well,
because,
we're at 2 hours now, 2.5 hours into this call.
Yeah, and I didn't particularly want to wind the call up because it's just gotten so bloody fascinating that I thought to myself it would just be a crime to just pull it. So I just, it was like, okay, here we are, having a fascinating conversation
well,
with some of the heavyweights of the ormus world.
Well, what I want to mention
call
here,
at once.
Right before we quit, and I want to mention that all of Jim's experiences were phenomenal. The puddle of water that came across the floor, the fibers of gold that came out of the backs of his hands, all of these experiences were phenomenal, and he used the knowledge that he got from those experiences, and we've all used the knowledge to figure out what Ormus is and how it works and what it does. That information is on my website. Most of it is. But it's spread all over the place. In my lectures and workshops, that's what I do, is I tie it all together and say, this is what he observed. This is what we think may have happened. This is confirmation from somebody else. He observed the fly ash. David Hudson observed the fly ash. Michael Burberry observed the fly ash. We don't have a picture of it, but maybe Michael Burberry will give us one. He observed the puddle of water. He observed the teleportation, stuff getting outside from the inside out or from the outside in. He observed that Ormus likes tight places. And we've come up with a theory about that. And this is all stuff that I sort of lay out step by step in my 14-hour workshop, two-day workshop. And that's, someday it's going to be on a disc. Someday it's going to be on a video. But that's what you get when you get a workshop. And I come and talk to you. And people that go to these workshops then share this information with other people nearby, and we see where there's an incredible activity of people doing research and looking into this stuff and working together with it. Sydney has 39 people on the Sydney Forum. There's 120 people in Los Angeles. We should see the same thing happening in Los Angeles. Anyway, that's enough for me. I do want to mention that the winner of the drawing for this week is Lon Smith.
Who?
Lon Smith. I met
Lon
in North Carolina when I did a presentation there.
So the very first Tommy Ormus is making its debut via the Ormus raffle.
Well, I have found this discussion very energizing. So I guess if we're done, I'm going to sign off. I've got to go get my girls and take them to church.
Okay.
Good on you, buddy. It's great to hear you on the call.
It's 8:23 in the morning here.
Yeah.
I had to get up at 5:30 to get on the call.
Well, good for you.
I'll take a nap, though, later.
Yeah. Enjoy your day, mate.
Okay, thanks a lot. Talk to you guys later.
See you soon.
Thank you all.
Bye-bye.
So listen, guys, let's wind up this call. Let's call it a day. It's a day.
Can you run your Skype number back at me again? I'm trying to, I can't get you on my con.
A-H-D-E-N-I-S.
A-H-D-E-N-I-S? Hang on, I'll type this in. A-H-D-E-N-I-S, yeah. That's it?